guess so.
My name is Mark. I am an alcoholic. I think about when you guys are coming over getting chips and everybody's telling you I got 8 months, 13 days, or 9 months, 14. I got 3 years, 3 months, and 26 days sober. And it took me, this was my 19th year of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it took me 19 years to get that long, that short a time sober. And I don't know what I'm going to say tonight. I don't know my sponsor. I was here in October. Anybody here in October? The blind guy with the patch, anybody was here that night? Okay, that's my sponsor. And also there was a lady here that night, Mary. Did anybody know Mary from this group? You know, that was the last time I got to see her. She killed herself on Thanksgiving weekend. Okay, as a direct result of drugs and alcohol and not willing to do the steps. Couldn't get it. And that really affected my sponsor a lot. He worked the steps with her, and I was sitting there thinking about, I don't want to be down tonight. I got such an exciting story of being sober, but I got the same story of, I got the same story of every alcoholic. You know, I'm an alcoholic because I have an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. And, you know, when I first went to rehab in 1993, I couldn't quit drinking, and they asked me this silly question. They said, do you obsess over alcohol? I didn't know what obsession was. And I said, what do you mean? They said, do you ever think about drinking while you're at work? Like, well, yeah, well, who doesn't? That's why I work. You know, I mean, it's like, okay. So I didn't get that part of it, because to me that was normal. That was my way of thinking. Right? And they said, well, yeah, I don't remember them talking about the allergy of the body and the allergy about when I take a drink, I can't stop. You know, for a lot of years, I'd get up in the morning and my wife would say, are you going to get drunk today? I would say, no. I would say, no, I'm not going to drink. And by noon, I was drunk. But, you know, when I told her that in the morning, when I told my kids, yeah, I'll pick them up from school, I meant it. You know, I meant it. I didn't think I was going to get drunk. And then that thought would come in my head that, hey, I don't like the way I feel, or, you know, I'll just have one shot. I have one beer. And I did. I used to buy them one at a time. One big bottle at a time. And I'd drink that, and I would go back, and I would go back, and I would go back. It got so bad at the end of my drinking that I couldn't leave my house, and I own a company, and I would pay employees to come. I have a fire hydrant by the front of my house, and I was trying, I don't know if anybody, has anybody here ever tried to sneak their drinking or hide it from their families? Has anybody ever done that? Because if I'm the only one, I don't want to talk about it if you can't relate to it.
Come on.
Okay. I had this employee that he made his overtime pay by coming to my fire hydrant, leaving me a bottle of whiskey, and taking the money I left in an empty cigarette pack. Because I was too drunk to leave the house, and I didn't think anybody else knew that. You know, I didn't think anybody in the house knew that I was drinking or using drugs at the time. I did do a lot of outside issues. But I realized that I started with alcohol, and that's where my problem is. That made me fit in. I grew up in Southeast Los Angeles. I grew up about two blocks where they beat up Reginald Dean. That was the only white kid in the neighborhood. On this side of the tracks was the black people, and this side of the tracks were the Mexican people. And then my family moved there in the 40s. And I've never fit in. I went to a little white Baptist church in the middle of a Chicano neighborhood. I went to a white Baptist school. And all these other kids were out there having fun. And we had to behave. And I was raised in a very strict religion. And, you know, I mean, I've been baptized 6 times. Okay, because I was such a pain in the ass kid that I always thought, well, if I go down there and go down to the altar, get on my knees, pray to God, save me, tell everybody, hey, I'm saved, get baptized again, I'll be okay. And then every time I got baptized, it didn't fill the hole in me. It didn't fill the hole. I still didn't fit in. I wasn't like anybody else. And so I was playing Pop Warner football, and I had a drink with four guys. It was simple Schutz malt liquor beer. And it scared me to death because alcohol was taboo in my house. And but you know what? I felt like the guys liked me. I felt like the guys liked me. And that was my first drink, and I was so afraid when I got home my mom was going to beat the hell out of me. And they talked about in the big book that that we're driven by 100 forms of fear. And right now I'm sweating so much I'm afraid of all of you guys. You know, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, when I get drunk, you know, I become a very brave person. I have a lot of violence in my story, and I don't focus on that anymore. But I don't have anything to be afraid of here. I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I was in Los Angeles yesterday working, and I came home so I could be here tonight. And the reason I'm here tonight is because alcohol wreaks such havoc on my life and my kids that I know if I don't come to these meetings, I'm going to drink again. This is the only place that I found a way not to drink. This is the only way I found a place not to try to kill myself again or kill other people. In 1985, I was in a hurry to get home because I wanted to get loaded, and I ran over a man and I killed him. Okay? Alcohol and drugs have never given me anything good in my life. Okay, April 27th in 2007, I married my high school sweetheart at 17 years old. She was Mexican, I was white, and I thought I was getting in, and she thought she was getting out. Okay, and it was a match made in heaven. Okay, I still live with that woman today, even though we're not married. Okay, and she is a typical codependent. You know, I went to my first rehab and we parked my truck in the driveway because I wouldn't let her drop me off because I needed my car because I was going to leave. Right? Because I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I didn't even know what alcoholism was. Parked the truck and I got the keys, and so her and the counselor took my spark plug waters and mixed them around, so if I decided to leave, I couldn't leave. Like that would stop me. And then we progressed. We got through that one, through that rehab. I made it 26 days in a 28-day program, and we were playing volleyball, and I'm so competitive. You know, I don't know if any other alcoholics are competitive, but I'm playing volleyball in a rehab center, right? And we're chasing the balls around. This guy wasn't moving fast enough, so I push him out of the way, and he turns around and tells me, "Hey, don't pick on me." And I just clocked him. And I said, "Hey, you know what? Maybe this isn't for you. You just need to go to AA meetings." While I was in that rehab, I went to a Friday night Cocaine Anonymous meeting. And in Clovis, a lot of guys went to AA and CA at the time. And I followed these guys around that said they were sober for like 15, 20 years. And I kept following them to the bathroom. Because I've been in this rehab, right, for 14, 15 days at that time. They let me out in my first meeting. And these people were so happy that I knew they were getting high in the bathroom of this meeting. And I'm following them. That's true. I'm following these guys around, right? And they just keep coming back. And I think, like, you guys are just being bogarts, you're not sharing. And it goes on and on like that for a lot of years, but then I'm right on the outskirts of the program, and the only time I want to quit drinking is when my wife is mad or I'm going to lose a job. So for a lot of years, I come to AA meetings, and my home group is Sierra Fellowship in Clovis, and we used to be in Peacock Market up there, and it had a front door and a back door. And I lived right over the fence, and so I'd go park my big red Suburban in front of it, and I'd walk through, and I'd sit in the back of it and drink behind the fellowship, and I'd walk back through and get my truck so she could see my truck there. That was my idea of going to an AA meeting. Okay, so we fast forward to 2007, and things are pretty bad. I've been sober for about 11 months back in, 2005 or so, and I was building a car wash in Modesto, and I'm driving back and forth every day, and I finished this project. I'd lost a job. I went to jail again. I'd lost a job, so I had to go back into business for myself, and I have a knack for working. And I'm talking to AA people on the phone, right? I'm doing back and forth to try to stay in touch, but I'm still not part of this thing. I don't understand. And then one day I said, today I'm going to get loaded. And I remember I stopped and I bought some whiskey, and I bought a half pint of whiskey. My wife was out of the country, and nothing happened. I drank the whiskey, and nothing happened. Two and a half years later, on April 7th, 2007, I was arrested twice in the same day for the same thing. Okay? And what had happened was, from the time that I took that, I hadn't drank in about 11 months, and that day I remember driving down 99 saying, when I get to Clovis, I'm going to get that, and I just drank that half pint, and it started from there, and within 2 months, I was drinking and using every day again. Every day. I couldn't stop, and that's all that mattered. I could stay sober long enough to do my billing, give my employees a way to their instructions, and that was it. And it'd get to the point, and all I could do, I could just sit in my backyard, and I just sit there by the boat because no one else is drinking. I got four kids at home. I got this wife that's a school teacher, and she's extremely let down. And I don't know why I can't stop drinking. I don't know why I can't. But she'd ask me, like I said, every morning, she'd say, "Hey, are you going to drink today?" I said, "No." And I meant it. It talks about the doctor's opinion. It talks about we're irritable to restless and discontent until we can find that relief that we see other people getting, right? And then we inevitably we're going to drink again, right? And for me, as an alcoholic, for me to drink, I get drunk. I never sat down and said, "Let's have a beer," right? Most people don't buy half a pint for a drink and sit down and drink it on ice. That's not what normal drinkers do. And And then it says, you know, that I wake up from that spree, you know, an alcoholic wakes up from that spree swearing that they'll never do it again. You know, and I swore that, and I meant it. I remember laying down in my front room going, God, I'm not going to drink today. God, keep me sober. God, keep me sober. And in about 2 hours, I'd be drunk. And my wife would come home, and she'd look down the driveway. And I of course, you know, my wife's a school teacher. And I'd get up in the morning. And you talk about the unmanageability and step one. And I'd get up in the morning, and I'd help get the kids off to school. And I'm hurrying, right? So I'm impatient. I need to get them out of there. You gotta go. And I get them to school. I mean, I could get a kid dressed that quick and a bowl of cereal out the door. Give me the bowl. Thank you. Goodbye. You know, and she would leave. And I know that she's going to get off at 2:45. She's going to leave the school at 3:15. She's going to be home at 3:30. And every day, about 2:30, I say, I got to quit drinking. I got to be sober in 45 minutes. Now, I just finished drinking a fifth of whiskey again. Right, but I'm going to be sober. I'd run to Carl's Jr. I'd get a big star or a famous star. I'd make myself eat it. In my mind, if I could eat, I'd be sober. All I was a full drunk, you know. And so I'd sit there, and she'd come in, and she'd pull into the driveway, and she'd look back, and her face would change. She'd have this look of hope that maybe he's not loaded today. And her face would change. And then I'd become an idiot because I was so embarrassed of my behavior. It's like, don't mess with me. Don't say nothing to me. Woman, I told you. You know, that macho stuff, that machismo stuff. Like, hey, don't mess with me. I ain't hurting you. I paid your bills. You know, and all that grandiose thinking. And really what I felt inside was that I felt lonely. I felt ashamed. I felt embarrassed. And that was a daily thing. You know, in the vision for you, it talks about how we... I got to remember, I'm just an alcoholic anonymous meeting. You know, I'm not running for office or anything else. I'm here tonight, so I stay sober. I got really nervous right now. You know, so much stuff. I don't think like a normal person. I start with a thought over here, and 20 minutes, I'm 30 thoughts down the road over here, and me trying to get my experience, strength, and hope out to you is like petrifying me right now. You know, and you know, I ended up by myself in hotel rooms, just drinking and using, and I would call them, not to be disrespectful, this is my story, and I wish it wasn't part of it. I'd call in the newspaper, you know, I'd call escort services, and I was so miserable, I'd call the dancers, and I'd say, hey, you know what, don't bring any of your dancing clothes in, just bring your sweats. You know, we dress like that, and I'd get there, and I was so miserable alone, I'd say, can I take you to dinner, can you just be my friend? And, you know, and I would pay just for company. There was no sex involved in it because I was incapable of it. That's where my dream. There was no romance or anything like that. That's because I couldn't be at home, right? So, and then I got where I couldn't leave the house. I couldn't drive my car. I couldn't stay sober, and so I couldn't leave. And my house became my prison. And so that last night I was drinking, and what had happened was I called one of those ladies. I asked her to come over to my house. And by this time, my family's locked themselves in the second story of our home. And every night, that's what they would do. They would slide the doors in front of the bedroom doors because they didn't know what Dad was going to do. I'd set fireworks off in the house. I'd start a fire in the backyard. I'd start my boat up in the middle of the night. It's out of the water. It's in my driveway. I'd burn my boat motor up. Because this made sense to me. You know, I'm drinking, and I just do stupid stuff. And then I invited one of these ladies over, and they came over in the morning, and I sat and watched some movie. Right, and we're locked in this room, and in the morning, Gabrielle came downstairs, and she went to get the paper, and this lady's leaving, and Gabrielle says, who are you? She said, well, I was with that guy in there, right? And I was so drunk, and Gabrielle came, and she says, that's it. I'm done with you. I'm done with you. And I'm sitting there, I'm looking at her, I'm kind of sitting there, and I'm in boxers, and I'm in a stretch t-shirt and flip-flops. And she's like, well, she goes, you got to leave. I said, I'm not leaving. She goes, yeah, you're leaving. She goes, in fact, you just hit me. She slaps herself. Right? And she dials 911. Now, you know, you guys have been in those positions, right, where you know it's time to leave. So I get in my car, and I'm driving across town. I'm going to an Alcoholics Anonymous member's house, because I have no friends. So I'm driving to this guy's house, and the police are calling me. So, Mr. Waters, you need to come home. I said, oh, no, she's crazy. I can't go back there. You know, and she goes, well, where are you? I said, I'm going to work. I'll be home after work. And, you know, I've always worked the system. I've always got myself out of trouble. She's always got Madge, and that's not the worst thing I've done to her. And So I go, I turn myself in, and they psych me out, and I go get cleaned up, eat a burger. I don't drink anymore, and I leave the police station, and I have this bright idea that I'm going to change the locks on this end of the house. And through my alcoholism and my drinking, I built this giant house. I'm like the Winchester house. I just kept building. That's why I'm a builder, and I get bored, and I build things. I go pull permits, and I have these grandiose ideas, and Debbie will attest to it. Right? And that's part of my story and part of getting sober. So I got this house that started at 1,800 square feet, and now it's almost 6,000 square feet. Right? And I just kept building and building. And so I'm going to go home, and I'm going to change the locks of 3,000 square feet of it. Half of it's mine. Right? And she'll stay over there, and I'll stay over here. And I went up, and I don't, you know, I bought a bag of cocaine and a bottle of whiskey, and I've got the evening planned. You know, I'm going to stay over here, and they're going to stay over there. Right? And so, because I paid rent. And so she walks in the door, and I'm trying to change it. I'm drunk again, and I'm trying to change the doorknob, and she picks up my Makita drill, and she throws it at me. I'm like, that's crazy. And she picks up the phone, she goes, my husband just threw a drill at me. Can you come get him? So I jump in my car, and I go around the corner. I'm on my cell phone. Hey, my wife's crazy. Right? I said, where are you, Mr. Waters? Well, I'm in Sierra and Barstow, or a villa in Barstow. She said, why don't you wait there for us? So I'm starting to think the police are on my side. They're going to understand this. Right? So I'm standing there. This time I'm dressed, though. And I'm standing there, and then they set me down. And you know, it's April, right? Right? So it's not real hot yet, and I'm sweating. I'm sweating, and it's taking too long to get her out of the house. And before long, they got me handcuffed. And I'm going, this ain't going to turn out good. And that morning, we did the race to the bank. You know, that race to the bank where, I don't know why, you know, some of that thinking I had, I did that, I woke when I after the first arrest, and before I went and turned myself in to get that citation, I ran to the bank, and I got all the money out of my business out. And the only voicemail she left me that day was, you're a son of a bitch. What is she talking about? And later she told me, she says, I guess she got to the bank 3 minutes after I did. You know, so I got all this money, and my oldest daughter comes down, and Clovis is a small town like Visalia, and she's standing there, and she's trying to get my money. Right? And I got $15,000 in my pocket, and I'm a big shot. You know, I'm a big shot. You know, I've got a defense attorney, I've got a Bell's bond, and I'm going to stay in jail. I'm going to do that because I'm in control. And I get arrested, and the cop gave me a restraining order, and they said, you know, you can't go back to your house. Now, I've been arrested twice for the same thing in the same day, but this time it's a felony, and I haven't done anything. This is the first time that I ain't touched her. I haven't done anything, but she's had it. She's come to the point, and I didn't know what to do. And I get out of jail, and they didn't impound my truck. You know, I'm a good old boy, and I'm part of the community. In fact, I built the cabinets in the police department. You know, they know me, and they're saying, Mark, you're going to get some help. I'm like, yeah, whatever. And I get out of the police department, and I realize I have nowhere to go. I'm 42 years old, and what do you do? I have no one to call. And the first thing I did, I went and bought another pint of whiskey. But, man, for some reason, I don't want to spend this money. And I called my mom. I said, Mom, I need to come home. And she says, come home. I'm always in Los Angeles. I drive to L.A., and I don't drink this whiskey. And she takes me to my mother, 42-year-old, takes me to AA meetings. She said, maybe you need to give that AA thing a try. So whatever, I'll go. And I went to meetings, and I cried, and all I talked about was, my wife's leaving me. You know, my wife's leaving. That's all I get focused on. I'm not thinking that I got a problem with alcohol. Right? And so life goes on. I end up, I rent this house bigger than the one I own because I'm going to show her. Right, I'm spending $15,000 a month on expenses because I'm going to get her back. The kids are going to want to be with me. You know, all that grandiose stuff. And I can stay sober 4 or 5 days at a time, and I can drink. And I got this family therapist that's going to fix her. She won't show up to him. So she showed up once. She showed up once, and she says, okay, I'll come in for an assessment. So we came over sitting there. I'm thinking, yeah, this is going to be good, right? We're going to get through this. I'm going to stay sober. And I'm thinking, this is good. Well, as I walked out of the assessment, she's hugging me. Right? There's this guy out there, and he gives me my divorce papers. And I think we're working on the relationship. And I start running around the parking lot screaming and crying because I don't realize that this woman can't fix me. I just know if this woman leaves me, it's the end of me. And so she gave me my divorce papers. And I don't know what to do. And, you know, and I go to this meeting, I go to this men's breakfast, and I'm obsessed over this woman. I got a good looking old lady. I really do. And that's my opinion. And that's the only one that matters as far as that goes. But you know, I'm very selfish in possession. I didn't realize, in Dr. Bob's story, it talks about we take the finest women hostages. And I had her hostage for a long time. Now, I also realize now that she had me hostage in her sickness. But I'm going to this men's breakfast, and I'm hungover, and I got a sponsor at the time, and I call him in the parking lot of the Waffle House on Clovis Avenue, because I still don't understand this AA thing. I don't understand what you guys are doing. I don't understand how you don't drink when you're not at these meetings. Right? And so I go in, the only place to sit down in this men's, and I call my sponsor. I'm on the phone to my sponsor. I don't want to go in there. And he says, well, don't go in there then. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you don't have to go to the men's breakfast. He says, in fact, why don't you go get drunk? Because you're not done. And I got pissed. Telling me I can't go to AA breakfast? You know, I'm an alcoholic. You have to let me in there. And he says, and if you do go in there, get another sponsor. Oh, talking about feeling alone. So I walk in, and the only place to sit down is between Matt and another guy in the fellowship. And, you know, Matt's kind of scary. I mean, he's got half a face. He wears a patch. You know, and he talks about sobriety all the damn time. You know, this other guy didn't like him either. But the only place to sit, I sat down, and he says to me, Matt says to me, he says, how are you? So I'm fine. And he goes, yeah, really? He goes, I'm blind. I'm not stupid. Really, how are you? And so I go into the story. I'm crying. Oh, she's leaving me. She's divorcing me. He goes, well, she ain't your problem. I said, this is drinking. He goes, I'm drinking ain't your problem either. He goes, you don't want to live. You don't want to live. You know, when I was a kid, you know, I was put on the porta potty backwards. They stole my red wagon. My bike was stolen. My brothers looked better than me. All that stuff. And no one taught me how to live. You know, but none of that stuff made me an alcoholic. Okay, well, you know, what makes me an alcoholic is back to the obsession of the mind and allergy of the body. And this man told me, he says, if you'll call me, I'll give you some CDs and I'll help you and I'll show you what I did to stay sober. Well, I ain't got nothing to lose. But I'm afraid of this guy, right? And I'm afraid this guy can't see me, but I'm afraid of him. He says, come over to my house, and I call him. I pick up the phone, and I haven't really called anybody in this program, and I call him. He says, well, come over and pick up these CDs. Well, I go pick up my 14-year-old and my 6-year-old. Well, at that time, they would have been 11 and 6. So I'm going to take these two little girls in front of me. Now, here's this guy with a patch, and when he takes his shirt off, he's got all these bullet holes and scars in him. He looks worse from the neck down than he does from the neck up, believe me, guys. And I say this with all affection, and he would have no problem me saying this. And I walk up, and my 6-year-old, you know, she's naive as a child is, and here's this guy with no patch on. When he doesn't have his patch on, he's all clear, and he comes to the door, and she stands there. She goes, hi, my name's Brianne. Right, more than I could do. And my 11-year-old says, hi, I'm Lauren. All they know is that dad has treated them like hell, and they've been through hell, and this is where dad's going to get sober, and he gives me the CDs. I'm still living in this house by myself, and I'm listening to the ACDs, and the first one was a guy named Mickey Bush, and the only thing I remember hearing on this tape is that he says, I don't think right, I think different. You know, people don't think like me, and he talks about the story when he comes home, and he's from England, and he walks in, and his mother hollers down the stairs, you know, drunk again? And he goes, me too, Mom, you know? And I understood that. It was the first time I related to an alcoholic, you know? You know, and that's the way I can understand that. And he talked about denial, D-N-I-A-L. Don't even know I am lying. I'm like, wow, that's cool. You know, but I've still got that loneliness, that despair, and the world's falling. But they said, okay, call us before you drink. Call us before you drink. And I was doing okay with that. I was doing all right. You know, I'm calling them, hey, you know, and I'm not telling them, hey, I'm lonely, I'm miserable, you know, I'm worried about her. I'm just like, oh, yeah, the meeting was great today, wasn't it? Oh, that was a cool meeting. Yeah, I'm glad I was there. And inside I'm dying, and I don't know what to do. And I had to go to Oakland to go to work, and the streets in Oakland, when you get off the A80 freeway, start at 1, and they go, my number's getting bigger, and I drove 22 blocks at 1:30 in the morning, caught every red light, okay, to get to a Safeway. Right, because I go, where's the store? And I just started driving down, I'm coming out of Alameda, and I drove 22 blocks, I found a Safeway, I went and bought a bottle of whiskey. And that was September 25th on 2007. And I drank that whiskey, and I couldn't get any relief, and I'd been sober for about 15 days, and I called Matt, and I said, Matt, you know, I want to be sober, what can I do? And he says, when you get back in town, come to my house, and we'll work the steps. But he also told me, he says, I'm not going to waste my time with you. I'm not going to waste my time. He says, if you want to do what I do, you can do that. And from September 26, 2007, I haven't had a drink. And what happened was, she said, call me. If you think about drinking, you call me. Well, he didn't know what he was in for. Because I think about drinking all the damn time. I called that man 17, 18 times a night. He'd tell me, and I had other men I was calling, and they're saying, they give me that phone list. But I got where I didn't want to take the phone list, and I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I come in the meetings, and the guys say, hey, and I'd leave early, because I'd come, I hated saying I'm a newcomer. Well, these people all know me, and I can't even think about going to a different meeting, because that's embarrassing to go to some meeting where I don't know anybody, but it's embarrassing to say I'm a newcomer. And so I'm coming in, the guys follow me out, and they go, hey, we got a phone list for you. I said, I don't want it. I don't want it. They go, well, here it is. If you want it, you can have it. I drive around the block, and then I feel like an idiot. Well, I got to go back and get the list, and then I'm walking in the gutter, and these guys are looking out the window going, ah, there's that newcomer. But I got the list, and I got all these phone lists, so I start calling people. My head starts telling me, hey, it's a good idea to drink. No one likes me. I'm never going to be like everybody else, and I'm by myself. Well, that's what I do. I drink. I drink. Right? So I start calling them, and I call him. I go, Matt, I'm thinking about drinking. He goes, really? He goes, I go, what do I do now? He says, I'll go to bed. I said, really? So I go, what time is it? I go, 11 o'clock. Well, yeah, go to bed. So I get upstairs. That's the first thing I did. I couldn't sleep, and I got this big two-story house, no furniture, and they made me put a bed in the bedroom. And I'm supposed to sleep in the bed. Well, I can't sleep in the bedroom. They hear voices. There's people in there. It's crazy at the time. And so I go up there and get in bed. I call him back. I say, okay, I'm in bed. What do I do now? And he says, well, go to sleep. You guys think I'm kidding? This is a true story. He said, go to sleep. I said, really? I can't sleep. He goes, read the damn big book. I promise you, you'll go to sleep. And so I'm reading the big book, and you read the doctor's opinion, you're trying to follow. Oh, you put your right to sleep. You get to the part about the employers, oh, that's a good sleeping pill. So I'm going to meetings, and I'm having to work out of town, and I'm calling this man, and I can't sleep, and I'm out looking for her in the middle of the night. I'm driving up down 168, and I'm looking for her. And my sponsor's kind of screwed up. He's really kind of mean, and I'm saying, man, I'm out looking for her, and I know I shouldn't be looking for her, and I should be home working on my step, but she said she went to her mom's, but I'm afraid to drive over there and look to see if she's really there. And I don't know if you guys, anybody can relate to that obsessive thinking, because I got to control this other person. And my old lady's and I know that my old lady's honest. And I know she's right where she says she is. I know that in my head, but my other side of my head says, no, she's going to meet Mr. Wright on the white horse, and I got to kill him. I got to kill him because I'm nothing without her. And so he says to me, this is just what he says, and he's talking, he goes, well, you'd really be screwed up if I told you she's over here spending the night with me, wouldn't you? I'm like, you're a bastard. I got to go off the freeway and drive to his house to see if she's there. Right? And he's laughing. And I go, why'd you do that? He goes, you're not thinking about you anymore, are you? No. He goes, you're thinking about me, huh? Well, yeah, I think I'm killing you. And we sat there and we went to A Vision for You. And he got out the big book and he gave me another CD. And then it goes on, and that's probably about 60 days sober. In December, I'm 24th, or December 26th of that year, I'm calling, I'm rambling on about something. I don't know if there's any old-timers here. I'm not an old-timer. I'm still new. But he really believes in working with other people, and he knows a lot of people, and I'm rattling on. He goes, okay, are you done? Okay, I'm done. I'm expecting him to fix it. He's going to write down this phone number, and he gives me the phone number of this man, and he says, when you get off calling me, I want you to call this man, his name's Mike, and ask him if there's anything you can do for him. Look at the area code. I know he's not in California. What am I going to do for this guy? So I call him, and I said, Mike, my name's Mark. Is Mike there? He goes, yeah, my name's Mark. And Matt Green told me I had to call you and ask you if there's anything I can do for you. He goes, oh, did he tell you my wife died yesterday? And he's always telling the screwed up stuff to me. I get off the phone, and I'm talking to this guy I don't know, and he's got a dead wife. And I'm like, what does this have to do with not drinking? I come back and say, look, dude, you got to start sponsoring me a little bit better because this stuff's getting screwed up. I said, I'm really uncomfortable with you talking about my wife being at your house and calling people a dead wife. This is really bugging me. And he says to me, he says, Mark, you're so self-centered, I wish you would drink. He goes, because if you drink again, I don't have to sponsor you. And I think I'm doing so good, man. I'm reading the 12 steps at the meetings, how it works. I'm writing out these beautiful 4 steps. And I got serious about being sober. I'm going to kill myself. I knew where I was going to kill myself. I knew how I was going to do it. And he says, if you'll just do this. And so we started going through the steps. And I went through step 1.
And that's where I found out about the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body, the doctor's opinion. And he had me do it over and over and over again. I listened to these AACDs, Joe and Charlie. It's called The Journey to Recovery. And they explained the first 164 pages. I was driving from Carruthers home, and this guy in the CD says, you know what? People that are allergic to peanuts don't eat peanuts. People that are allergic to strawberries don't eat strawberries. And it hit me, and he says it in soul. So people that are allergic to alcohol shouldn't drink alcohol. The problem is my mind won't let me not drink alcohol. So I have to do these steps as a sufficient substitute. Because without drinking, I'm still crazy. You know, I'm still, the head's going, and I need outside source. And the book tells me that no human power can relieve my alcoholism. So we're going through it, and I, because of my church background, we get to step two. And I don't understand this higher power. And to me, when it says higher power, that does not say G-O-D. It doesn't say God. You know, I just did what you guys did, and I believe that the people in this room is a power greater than myself. Okay? And I quit wanting to have that drink every day. And then we got to step three, and I think that I got the God thing down, and he has me make a list of what God would be if I could choose my own God. Well, that goes against everything that I was taught. But I make this list. And we read, and he says, okay, are you ready to say the third step prayer? And I said, yeah. And he said, let's get on our knees. And we got on our knees. And when he got on his knees, it just blew me away because I didn't know people in AA prayed. I didn't know that you guys prayed. Right? But well, where I came from, we prayed. So, okay, well, this is probably going to be okay. And I had my first spiritual awakening. And I felt free and I felt part of. And so, and I didn't know what a resentment was, you know, and he goes, write down everybody you're pissed off about all the way back. And I got to go all the way back to my t-ball coach. And I made that first column. And then I wrote down what everybody did to me. And then I wrote down what they affected, and then I did that last column. And you know what I found out? Because I was put on the porta potty backwards, didn't make me behave bad. Didn't make me behave badly that I, at some point, I crossed that imaginary line and made me an alcoholic, and I behaved terrible when I drank, but I was selfish whether I drank or didn't drink. And I went through these steps, and I made a list of my character defects, and I asked God to remove them. And I got to step eight, and I made this stuff, these. And what I had was a baggie, and I had all these 5x8 cards, and I had to write them down, and I clip them together. And then my sponsor had me write it down, you know, at the line of it, you know, this is what I affected, this is what I did, this is how I think I affected you. Is there anything that I can do to make this right? Is there anything you'd like to say? That's the screwed up part about step nine. Right, that last part where you ask them to talk to you. You know, if I just walk up and say, hey, I did this to you and I was wrong, I gotta leave, that'd be cool. Right, and I go and he says, I get through my first one with my sister-in-law and I order some money. And you know, those financial amends are very hard for me to make. It's easy for me to tell you I was wrong, I stole money from you, but I'll get it to you. You know, and this time he says, no, you're gonna give her the money. So I go and I'm shaking and I'm literally shaking and I got these bags and I'm shaking my knees and you know, she's about 5 foot nothing. And I'm not afraid of her, but I'm afraid because you know what, the humility that came with that step nine to say, hey, I disrespected your house. I affected you financially and I took food out of your kid's mouth. Okay, when I stole your money. All right, is there anything that I can do? And she just hugs me and says, can you just stay sober? Okay. And I went to a guy's house that was in the program, one of my counselors from the rehab I went to. I go to his house, I'm going to write it. I thought he'd be an easy one. He slams the door on me. He goes, how long have you been sober? I said, 5 months. Get out of here. Come back when you're serious. I was pissed. I said, doesn't he know I worked the steps? No, he doesn't think I worked the steps because I've been around for 20 years and I ain't done shit. You know, and so I'm in Bakersfield and I'm writing out my amends and I do. I'd write one. I'd go over with my sponsor. And I'm at Mimi's Cafe right off of, I think it's White, some White Lane or something down there at the end of it. And I leave my 8 steps all written in this baggie and I leave them in the restaurant. And I get all the way to Delano, I go, oh, I left my stuff there. And I turn around in the medium and I go back and I come and I say, you know, did you find a baggie in here? And she goes, oh yeah, with those cards in it. And like, it's got everything I've done to everybody. She's like, I still have them. Because when I finish making the amends, I put it in the other bag, and I keep them, and I date them when I did it, because I can see, I have to see the work. Because I give the lady $20, I said, please don't tell anybody what you saw on those cards. She goes, I can't even read your handwriting. You know, and then I'm thinking, I need my $20 back. You know, so I go to make this amends to this guy, and this financial amends, and I had a lot of financial amends to do, and I go, And I go to this guy and I say, this is what I did to you. And I, the deal we traded for the furniture and the work I didn't do for you, you know, I need to make this right. And what can I do for you? And he says to me, he says, you're going to make this right. He goes, well, you're going to make payments on this. I said, no, I can pay it all to you. He goes, all of it? I go, yeah, I can pay it all to you. I said, I've been sober this long and I can do this. He says, really? I think I'm really to give you the money right now. He says, you know what, Mark, that's exactly what I need to make my mortgage this month. I hadn't seen that man in 2.5, 3 years. I stole a bed from him, basically. I said I'd come to his house and do some remodeling work if he'd give me this bedroom set. And then I just abandoned it, you know. I got the bedroom set. I'll get there. I don't know if anybody relate to that. But I went and made those amends, and my ex-wife was with me. And the freedom, when I came out, I just sat and I cried, you know, because I got freedom from that stuff that I never thought those things would happen to me. You know, that's not cool. You know, I mean, I used to run the streets and I used to cruise Whittier Boulevard in Los Angeles, and I was a cool dude. I mean, I was cool. You know, I had a 63 lowrider with surf racks on it. I was so screwed up. And I never thought that I would belong anywhere. I never thought that I would not be afraid of people. And tonight when I was drunk coming down here, even though I'm nervous and I got sweaty, you know, this is my story. There's a lot to my story. I mean, there's 3 years in the Army, and there's 10 years in the oil field. You don't get sober until you're 42 years old. You can do a lot of shit. You can do a lot of stuff. And there's so many tragic stories of, like, when I'm pushing my kids' heads head in the cereal bowl because, you know, we've been strung out for so long, and when the old lady was drinking and using all that stuff. But, you know, I had that life. I had that. I've had money. I've had no money. I've success, not success. You know, I've had new cars. I've had old cars. I went from big house to a small house. And back to houses, I'm going to close with this. You know, my sponsor, I'm running out of money real quick. I'm sober 6 months. He's got me calling people. He's got me doing stuff, and I'm doing everything he tells me to do. I went to 1,100 meetings in my first year. I went to 3 meetings a day, period. 3 to 4 meetings a day because I'm sick. That's the only place I could get. But my wife says, well, I'm going to get this apartment. She says, well, you can move back in. I said, okay, but you have to build this wall, and you have to live on this side of the wall. I go to my sponsor. I go, I might call my sponsor and tell me to go to sleep. Hey, how can I get her to change her mind? She says, just build the wall. And I put a door with a double deadlock. I said, okay. So I do this. So I move back in the house. I'm close to my kids. That's all I wanted, to be a family man. And I'm living there. And I have to get up and go outside and knock on the door to ask for coffee. And I'm talking to my sponsor. I go, you know what? I didn't sign up for this. He says, just do it. Just do it. For 6 months. So then she would open the door and let me out in the morning instead of having to go around. Right? And I'm calling. I said, this is stupid. I'm pacing. I'm pacing at night. How can I get that door open? You know? Right? You know, but this guy says, do this. And experiences like that. You know, and now what happens is tonight before I came here, she still lives at her end of the house and I live on my end of the house. But the doors are open, and we laid down in front of the fireplace. I took a nap. Okay? Friday night, me and my kids, and I'm really going to close with this. I'm going to tell you how this program affects my family. My 9-year-old and my, she's 14 and 9 now, and we're playing cards, and Matt has to have a chauffeur, and he lives with a man named Jack in the program, and my kids go to meetings with me. They wanted to come tonight. I said, no, I don't want to come tonight. I need to be among alcoholics and be away from them sometimes. We're playing slapjack, and one of my friends in the program, his name's Jack, and Matt, and my 14-year-old sets down, and I go, you want to play? She goes, no. So she slaps her hand in. She goes, I'm Jack, and my 9-year-old says, no, I'm Jack, you're Matt. Right? And so then she wants to change the rules to the game. My 14-year-old does. I go, we're already playing. I said, you're a newcomer. And I didn't mean that you're a newcomer. I mean, you're a newcomer to the game, you know? And she's sitting there. She goes, Dad, I'm not a newcomer. I've been sober 14 years. Right? You know? And then my 9-year-old looks at me and she goes, you know, Dad, I got 6 more years sober than you do. And you feel you guys are laughing right now? That's a much better story than all the shit I put my family through. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a way of living in a way that I learned how to pray, and that no matter what, if I can be okay with me and God and right where I'm at and come to these meetings and make these phone calls, I don't believe that I ever have to take a drink again. Thank you.